Tim Cuthbertson is the Chief Science Officer at VelociGrow, and today we're going to talk about vertical agriculture and design of experiments. Tim, welcome to CC Life Science.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
My pleasure. All right, so for context, let's start out. Tell us a little bit about VelociGrow and what you all are trying to accomplish there.
Yeah, we're a company that's trying to improve the environmental friendliness of farming. And I think a lot of people don't know that when people grow plants, they're oftentimes using sort of non-sustainable plant growing media. And so we're trying to develop substrates that are based upon plants that compost readily and that don't hurt the environment when they're harvested.
So tell us, as an example, what some of those things are, those non-sustainable media and substrates.
Yeah, so one of the major substrates that's used is called peat. And the way it's harvested is basically they clear cut a forest and then they take the sort of topsoil, let it dry out over time, and then they scrape that off and then harvest it and then put it together in these sort of like plant growing plugs. And I think a lot of people don't realize that it can take 1,000+ years for that topsoil to regenerate. So it's basically non-renewable in our lifetimes. And I was just recently at an indoor agriculture conference and everyone was talking about how we can harvest more peat, which seems crazy to me because no one even talked about how environmentally unfriendly that was. They were just talking about how they could get more of it. But the substrate market as a whole on the planet is expected to quadruple over the next 50 years. So if you can imagine the environmental impact of today's agriculture on peat, imagine it going four times as much, and that would be just pretty much terrible. So we need new alternative substrates that are completely sustainable. Ours is based upon a polysaccharide from plants, and it can be renewed extremely rapidly and then composted afterwards.
Nice. So I'm curious, isn't peat, like if I go to my local nursery and buy some things, I might find peat in some of those little containers, right?
Yeah, like if you're going to Home Depot or whatever and you're buying Miracle-Gro or any of those other products, you're buying peat in most cases. There's some other alternatives like coconut coir, which, you know, comes from the husks of coconuts, and that's renewable and good in that way. However, it also brings other problems, like it could have little eggs in it of different flies or whatever. So as soon as you put water on it, you're hatching a bunch of flies. And that runs counter to everything you're trying to do when you're trying to grow plants without pesticides, right? You're bringing in foreign species from the other side of the planet, and that's not good for anyone. Ours is completely pest-free.
And tell us, describe the whole concept around vertical agriculture. What does it look like? You know, and it's indoors, I presume, as you say. So what kinds of things are you growing? And yeah, just give us a picture.
Yeah, so I think most people are familiar with greenhouses, right? Where you're growing inside of a controlled environment, and then you have basically windows on top that are letting the sun in. And that has to be done in a horizontal fashion where, you know, all the plants are growing side by side. Now, with a vertical farm, you're still inside of a building, but instead of putting it in this really large surface area, you're stacking the plants one on top of another. Because you're doing that, of course, you can't rely upon the sun to provide the light for your photosynthesis. So you got to provide some kind of alternative light. And most of the time these days, that's LED lighting. So you're able to grow hundreds of times as many grams of plant per, you know, square inch in a vertical farm as you would be able to in a sort of like regular field farm.
And yeah, so LEDs are ridiculously efficient. Talk about, but, and I'm just curious, this is a little sidetrack here because I have to ask about the spectrum of light that LEDs can put out obviously works for growing plants.
Yeah, so it's actually really beneficial because, you know, if you looked at, say, the natural sunlight, right, it's got all these different frequencies of light, all these different colors, but not all of those are active for photosynthesis. So what you really want with a plant is what they call PAR, or photosynthetic activating radiation. So you need to select those particular frequencies and show those to the plants. Now, depending on what stage of the plant you're, what stage of the plant growth you're in, or what plant you're growing, you can adjust the frequency of light to change the morphology of that plant, or to make it grow faster or slower, and to avoid things like tip burn, which is really something negative for, say, like lettuce. You wouldn't want the tips of your lettuce to be burnt. So adjusting that is very easy with LED technology, and more companies are coming out with specialized computer systems to control the frequencies of light.
Wow. Okay. I'm so glad I asked that. And does that save some energy?
Yeah. So
in the fact that you're not using the whole spectrum?
Exactly, right? So you don't have to put a bunch of light on the plant that the plant isn't going to use, or that's going to hurt the plant. In addition to that, you can change the frequency of the flickering of that light. So, for instance, you could tell the computer to turn the light off for a certain percentage of the time, say like 20, 50% of the time. Now you're saving 20 to 50% of the energy, because the plant doesn't really know that the light is off during those small flickering events. And so that is another way you can save a tremendous amount of energy.
I could dig way into that. So I recently, I'm geeking out because I have a ham radio license, but I'm starting to teach myself actual electronics with LEDs and circuits and all that. And just imagining, as you say, a computerized system. But I want to ask about, you know, having the lights flicker. Is it because I imagine the reactions in photosynthesis happen very quickly, and that they can continuously take in that light. But it sounds like they don't need to, it doesn't need to be continuous.
Right. So they're, yeah, exactly right. So the chemical reactions are happening like on a photon by photon basis. And so I believe the frequencies of light, frequencies of flickering, they're something on the order of like 100 to 200 hertz or something like that. So if you're flickering at that kind of rate, then the plant doesn't know the difference, and therefore you're able to save that power.
Wow. All
right. Yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating. All right. So talk about how vertical agriculture can make an impact. Obviously, you can grow more in a small area. And yeah, go on beyond that. I'm curious about relative to the massive acreage that's used for traditional agriculture, and it's not an either or, I imagine. But
right. So they kind of work hand in hand, and you know, we have more and more people on this planet. We need to grow plants in as many ways as possible. However, with a vertical farm, you're able to save about 98% of the water that you would use in a regular outdoor farm. So you can imagine like using 2% of the water, it's just so much better for the planet. In addition to that, you can grow so much many, you know, hundreds of times more plants in the same kind of surface area. Aside from that, now you also have to talk about what is the arability of various land that's available to you, right? So we use a lot of the arable land on our planet to grow plants on already. As the population gets higher and higher, we need to start looking at, can we grow plants in places that weren't traditionally good for growing plants, right? Like in very northern climates, or in deserts, or things like that, or in urban areas where people need fresh fruits and vegetables. So if you could, say, put a vertical farm in the center of a city, like some companies are doing right now, that land may not be very good for growing plants on its own, but when you put a building there and you control that environment, now you can grow plants right in the center of the city. Now people are getting very, very fresh fruits and vegetables right in the center of their city.
What kind of fruits and vegetables are we talking about? I'm presuming it's not apples on trees, but maybe someone's going to work on developing an apple tree that can grow there.
Yeah, so that's one of the great things about this controlled environment agriculture, is you can grow different species that wouldn't necessarily be allowed sort of outdoors, right? Outdoors, you're subject to whatever the wind and the rain and the sun is doing at that particular location. But if you can control that environment, you may be able to grow more fragile fruits and vegetables that wouldn't ship well or that wouldn't survive in a regular outdoor climate. So it sort of expands like the realm, and we may be able to grow fruits and vegetables that we've never even imagined at this point because no one ever tried to do it before. So the number of species is continuing to increase. Sort of initially, vertical farms have been focusing on sort of leafy greens like spinach and different types of lettuces and herbs and things like that. But more and more companies are starting to grow tomatoes and cucumbers and strawberries and things like that. So it's kind of expanding. And as the technology and the money comes in, then I think you're going to see more and more inventive things.
Strawberries seems to be sort of the one that popped in my mind first, aside from the lettuces, because of the way people sometimes grow them anyway. Now I'm going to really go off the track here and think about, I only learned last year that every apple tree is a graft, and the apple tree in my backyard is a graft. And now thinking about, could people develop a stalk onto which you could graft branches of apples, you know, in a controlled structure to produce apples indoors,
for example? Yeah, absolutely. You can do that. And of course, now you wouldn't be subject to the seasonality, right? And also, if you think about like, where are your apples coming from any given time of the year, if you're in North America, sometimes you're going to be buying them from somewhere in North America, but then sometimes you might be buying them from Chile or something like that. And of course, that has a carbon impact, right? You have to ship that stuff up, or you have to store it for long periods of time in some kind of a warehouse. You can take a lot of that stuff out of the equation if you take the seasonality out of it by putting it inside of a controlled environment.
Yeah, the carbon impact is really the one that gets me. I mean, I appreciate having blueberries from Chile year-round sometimes, but I also look at it and go, it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you're, say, like in Alaska, right, and you want to have blueberries, you know, it might have shipped from practically the other side of the planet, but with controlled environments, now you could grow them right there and have them year-round, and they'd be fresher and better than you could possibly get from anywhere else.
Right. I'm hoping to get another episode on here that might be a little bit contrary to this whole idea, but solving the ethylene problem in terms of food waste and how, you know, what we do to keep food from ripening when it's in a shipping container sitting outside the Panama Canal for a couple of weeks.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. We're having major issues with the Panama Canal right now, obviously. Another climate change issue, because they're not getting enough rain in Panama to run the canal. And I was just talking to a fertilizer supplier who said that they were trying to ship from the from Europe somewhere, I think, and go through the Panama Canal. But then their fertilizer weighed too much, so they dropped it off in Texas because they couldn't get it through the Panama Canal. So I think we're going to see more and more of these issues as time goes on. The climate's changing so much. We need alternative ways to do things so that we're not dealing with these issues, these supply chain issues.
Yeah. For people who aren't aware, I only learned this a few weeks ago, that the Panama Canal does not have enough water in the lake in the middle of it, which was a man-made lake to begin with. And now there's not enough rain, so the water isn't deep enough to accommodate fully loaded large ships without running aground. And so You never would have thought. I mean, the naive vision of the Panama Canal is it's just a cut through the earth and water flows from one side to the other, but that is not how it works.
So, yeah, it's all gravity fed. And if you don't have that water coming in, then it just doesn't work.
And so now it's a major issue in shipping of ships that have to, as you say, offload part of their cargo to raise the water line or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you all are using Design of Experiments. I did an episode on that about a year or so ago. Talk about how you're using that to develop your products.
So our products are a multi-component mixture. We have formulations that say have like 5 to 7 different components. And if you ask the question, like, how would you make the best formulation for a given application, how would you do that? And the sort of traditional way of doing that would be to change one of those variables at a time, right? So you would hold all the other five or six components constant, then change one and get that optimized. And then you would hold that constant and then change the others in sequence like that. If you can imagine for 5 to 7 components, that would be a tremendous number of experiments. And you would never be confident that you ever got the right answer, because a lot of those things are dependent on each other, right? So if I have like one that I'm holding constant, how do I know that once I change the other ones, I shouldn't change the original one again, right? So what we do instead is change all of those components simultaneously and then feed it into a computer program and tell the computer program what we want as an output, right? So we would tell the computer, for instance, in the plant growing arena, we want to maximize the germination of our plants, and we want to maximize the plant mass at the end of a certain period of time. And then we take the data from the plant growth, feed that back into the computer, and then it generates a model that is sort of minimizing the variance of the predicted outcome versus the actual outcome. Once you've minimized that and you've created a model, then you can tell it to do whatever you want. You could say, I want to minimize germination. I don't know why you'd ever want to do that, but you could tell it that, and it would tell you the best formulation that would minimize germination. Of course, we do the opposite. We tell it we want to maximize germination and maximize plant growth, and then the computer model then tells you the most likely combination of those components that would give you that outcome. And using this kind of method, we're able to rapidly create multiple different products. At this company, we were just a tiny company with 6 employees, but we've already been able to develop 12 new products at a rate of about 1 every 6 weeks using this technique.
That's amazing. So I just want to back up for people who don't understand. So when you say you're going to vary all of them, you're going to try multiple combinations of multiple variables.
Yeah.
Presumably, so we would, maybe with some guidance from the computer.
Right. So we would tell the computer sort of like what the estimated ranges of those components would be. And then we feed it into the computer and it will give us a bunch of candidate runs. So it could be, say, 15 to 30 different formulations that we would make. We would make those formulations, which doesn't take that much time. And then we would do the plant study. We would basically take those different formulations, grow plants in them, and then take the data from that and feed it back in. So it's about a 1 to 2 month cycle for us to sort of like collect those data and then make the new formulation.
And so you feed the data back in, and obviously it can tell you which one was best, but it might be able to look at what you started with and how it came out and make further incremental adjustments to some of those to say it's likely that some dialing up of some knobs might make a difference. Is that right?
Exactly right. And then you can continue to refine the model, right? So once you've created that model and you've got your sort of optimized formulation, you can then continue to make that formulation or variations of that formulation, feed those data back in, and then the model becomes more and more refined over time. So basically, it's a way to sort of make the best formulation, but also to then refine the formulation, and then also to ensure product quality over time, right? So you could use production runs in your factory, feed those data back in, and then continue to just get better and better. They call that quality by design, by the way.
Ah, I've heard of quality by design. I knew about it. Probably QBD. Almost in the same context, but never put those two things together, that's what QBD was. So clearly the design of experiments has made an impact in your workflow. I mean, particularly with the fact that, you know, plants don't grow like bacteria doubling every 20 minutes. So
right.
So you do want to save the time just to get an answer.
Exactly, right? It's like if you were doing sort of something that had a quick data feedback loop, experiments would be okay. But in the case of plants, when you got to wait a month for them to grow, you really want to optimize your time as much as possible.
Right, because time is expensive. That is awesome. What else do I need to know about either design of experiments or vertical agriculture to tie this whole thing together?
Well, really, like As I mentioned, you can use it to refine formulations. You can use design of experiments to refine formulations, but you can also use it to refine processes too, right? If you were to think of a process, say like popping popcorn in your microwave, you might want to know, for instance, what is the right amount of time to put my popcorn in the microwave, but also what is the right power level to make the most best tasting popcorn, right? And optimizing those independently would probably not give you the best result, but optimizing them together in a design of experiment situation would give you the best possible outcome and the most repeatable outcome, right? So we also use it for the processes that we design.
So can you give me an example of a process? I know the popcorn analogy.
Yeah.
But without giving away company secrets, is there a process you could describe, like what you're doing?
Yeah.
That would say?
So for instance, with many different compounds and that you're working with, they could be very heat sensitive, right? So if you get them above a certain temperature for too long, then it'll start to get degradation. Also, sometimes the stirring of a reaction may have a big impact on the final product quality. So what we can sometimes find is it's not just those two things independently that have an impact on the product quality, but the cross factor between those two. So if you stir it fast, for instance, you may only be able to heat it to a lower temperature, but if you stir it slowly, now you can heat it for a longer period of time at a higher temperature. And so what we get are those cross factors that you could never find if you weren't doing statistical design of experiments. You need to be able to use the software to do that.
Right. So the piece I was missing there was I was just imagining in your formulations, X amount of this, Y amount of that, not how do we put them together and do the reactions and obviously.
Yeah, those second and sometimes third order effects are extremely important to having a high quality product.
Nice. Tim Cuthbertson, this has been a blast talking to you about. I mean, we could go on all day about the LEDs and shipping from China and the Panama Canal, but I've learned a ton, and I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
It's been a pleasure, Chris, and anytime I'd be willing to talk to you.
Nice. Thanks.